you, Arthur. Well, thanks for having me here. I don't think I'm going to start off with a more optimistic topic than what we left off with yesterday evening. Or maybe a little bit. But it's true what Arthur was saying, that people tend to think when you say gender and climate, then they tend to think, what planet are you on? This is something that affects the whole planet. It's a big system, climate, and species are only part of it, and the human species is only one small part of it. And what difference could it possibly make if you're a woman or a man or a girl or a boy? So what I would try to do is give a few pointers why that indeed makes a difference in terms of causing climate change, mitigating climate change, and the effects of climate change and how they will affect us. Maybe as a precursor before, I'm not so much a scientist working on climate. As Arthur said, I'm a psychologist, so we're the kind of people who have something to say about everything. Usually we say it depends. But I've been having an interest in gender and women's rights issues for a long time, and since I started working on the sustainable development issues, I've been dipping in and out of gender, mostly because it's actually quite depressing, a topic to work on, because we have all these international agreements and declarations about the advancement of women, and equity and equality, but we're not really making that much of progress. So for a few years, I haven't been working so much on this. And then a colleague approached me to get involved in climate change issues. That was 2 years ago. That colleague, Ulrika, I want to acknowledge her here, because what I'm going to say is very much building on our joint work, including some of the photos that are in the presentation, which are really Ulrika's. And we're working on this from a non-governmental civil society perspective. That is, we're advocating. And what we're doing at the moment, or what we've done, is to develop some kind of a strategy to try and further the integration of gender issues and social concerns in general into the international policy making on climate change. And part of that is, of course, to go out and look, so what the heck do we actually know? And currently we're undertaking an overview of existing research together with the FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, who have a particular interest in social and in gender issues in this area. So this is where I'm speaking from. It's not research that I've done myself, but things that we have been reviewing from different disciplines. So what I'm going to try and do is to give a few reasons why gender should indeed be considered. And I'm just going to throw a few things at you in relation to causing and mitigating climate change and adapting to climate change. Now, I'm not so sure how familiar you all are with terms like gender mainstreaming, gender analysis, gender impact analysis, and things like that, so I'm going to leave them out mostly. But we already had over breakfast a little conversation about gender and about sex, and somebody was saying, gender is such a nice word, it sounds so much nicer than sex. And somebody else was saying, well, actually, you don't want to be without gender. So just as a reminder, the term sex is related, of course, to the biological differences, and the term gender to the social differences between girls and boys, women and men, as in identities, roles, and expectations towards people, just as a background. So talk about gender. So my general argument is that gender indeed makes a difference in relation to many aspects of climate change in different parts of the world. We had a bit more insight into the developing world yesterday, and you might think that's where gender impacts are most significant in terms of poverty and discrimination of women and so on. Well, that is, but not only, the case. We're working on this, I'm trying to entice you to think about these things, because we believe that taking this into account will help us to understand the full set of causes of climate change, climate damaging behavior, and the potential effects. And it will also help us to protect our climate more efficiently and to adapt to climate change. That's why we're doing this. It's not something for the sake of its own. Now, just as a maybe additional background, is that if you look at the Climate Change Convention or the Kyoto Protocol, you participate in negotiating processes on these issues. It is not a discourse like the sustainable development discourse. It is not a debate that is focusing on, okay, we have a major threat coming, what is causing this and what can we do about it, in the sense of how do we want to develop as communities, as a global community, in the face of this development. When I entered into that debate, I thought, oops, all natural scientists and economists and lawyers, and this is actually a discussion about emissions and curbing carbon emissions and emissions trading, and that was the end of it. This is probably a bit too strictly spoken. Maybe Handel can correct that later. But it is not a conversation that is encompassing the concept and the differentiations we have by now in the discourse on sustainable development. So there is really a need to push for that. And gender is an issue that you can use to highlight social aspects of an environmental issue very well. And because the issue of women's rights and the advancement of women and gender equity is so established around the United Nations, you actually, nobody will silence you when you do that. And it's a way to introduce questions of poverty and inequality and fairness into the conversation about climate change. So when you look at those agreements that we have so far on climate, I've been text searching all of them, including the IPCC documents up to the last one, and you find the term women, when you do a text search, mentioned in terms of, yeah, we should have more women in our workshops, and the UNFCCC Secretariat should look at its gender balance, and its staff and delegations should have some women on them. But that's about it. So we don't really have a consideration of that. Right. As I said, I wanted to talk about mitigation as well as adaptation. Mitigation, I'm referring a bit to the broader question of what causes climate change and how can we mitigate it. And then about adaptation. And I'm just going to give you some pointers where the gender aspects really are. If you want to look at mitigation of climate change, you could ask questions like, who is causing how many emissions and for what purpose? Not only north and south, but for example, male and female. Or you could ask, how can we best inform women and men about the connections between their behavior and climate change? Are there channels that we should use to reach women, and language and examples and information that we should use to reach women and their lives and their needs rather than men and the other way around? How can we help women and men to change their behavior and cause fewer emissions? Or what impacts do climate protection measures and mitigation policies have on women and men in their work, in their daily lives? For example, if you think about rising energy prices, does it affect women and men differently? So that's a few things that we know. Differences in energy use do indeed exist between women and men in terms of purposes and in terms of amounts. Now, just going to, for the sake of it, just refer to developed countries here, not developing countries. This is based on research, for example, done in Sweden, the country that always tops the gender equality index globally. And what you can see is that even in a country like that, where we have the highest global comparatively amount of equity between women and men, you see that women and men do fulfill different roles in society. Men are more engaged in income-generating work, and women are more, relatively more engaged in caring work in the family, looking after elderly, children, the sick. And you find, so that's the purposes that people use energy for transport for example. And you find that men are driving the bigger cars. They're also driving faster, and they're driving them for different purposes. For example, they drive further distances for their leisure than women would do. Just going to let this sink in. So you could say that men use energy for transport for purposes that are in line with their social status or their identity, if you want to use some social scientific terminology, or you could say, well, actually, some of these purposes are more selfish ones than women's energy use. I always put this first when I talk about this because it's the one thing that if you do a presentation about these issues in the developed world, it's the one piece of information that really doesn't go down. So just reflect upon your lives, you might find that. We might not. The other example where we have some good information available are transport systems, public transport systems. For example, you had a gender audit on transport done in the UK in the late 1990s by Professor Hamilton from the University of East London. It was something that the government supported and then did not publish for a number of years. One of the results is that, particularly when you look at rural areas in England, you find that the routing and the timing of public transport is really very much designed to suit the classical middle-aged income-generating man, the guy who works outside the home. He goes to work in the morning, comes back in the evening. It is not so much designed to allow a woman drop off her child at school and then go to work and still be on time for both. So that is something very, very simple that can actually hinder a woman to have a job or a part-time job to generate her own income. The result of that is often that the women have to buy cars to be able to get around, and the end of the story is often that's not worth it. Yeah? If you then have to invest so much money to actually go and earn some, you might as well stay at home. That has social impacts. So if you look at this from a climate perspective, what it means is if we designed the public transport system a tad differently, it would allow women to use public transport, allow more people to use public transport than we have at the moment, particularly women, which is more climate friendly than if everybody drives their own cars. Very simple things that we can find if we look closely. Another very interesting area is that women and men generally differ with regard to the perception of risk. Women are more risk sensitive. You might know this very well. People are nodding. Yeah, women are always so sensitive to risk, and they don't just go for it. They say, let's be cautious. That is indeed generally the case. Women are more avert to taking risks. And that also applies to their perception of climate change. They feel more strongly about the risks that are involved with the changing climate. They also believe less that the measures that are being taken at the moment are sufficient. So they're not quite sure that the convention we have, the Kyoto Protocol we have, and other measures that exist are going to be enough. So they're more concerned about the changing climate. They also tend to believe less in technological solutions or technological solutions only, meaning they will be more ready to consider that we have to change our lifestyles, that we have to change our behavior to mitigate the negative impacts of climate change. So you actually have a group of people there who would be natural allies to those people who argue very progressive and drastic measures for the protection of our climate. But very few women are actually involved or working in sectors that are relating to this field. We have very few women in decision-making positions in energy and climate-related fields. I'm going to give you a few figures. This is about the European energy sector. And the energy sector very, very much affects what's going to happen to our climate in the future. We were discussing coal and nuclear and oil, other fossil fuel use yesterday. So in the energy sector in Europe, you have 6% women in the technical professions, 3% women in middle management, and 1% in top management. It doesn't get more extreme than this, except maybe in the military. So this is also visible when you go into climate change debates around the UN. You have even more men than anywhere else. So it is a field where women actually are very few women are active. And if we look at it from a climate perspective, it might actually be very good if they were, because they are more risk sensitive, because they are more in favor of using a wide range of solutions, not only technological ones, to address the issue. So that's a bit of a shame that we have so few women there. And in Germany, for example, we've had 20, 30 years of campaigning and specific instruments and organizations who work to get more girls, women into the energy and related sectors without much success so far. We maybe can debate the reasons for that later. Another aspect that I believe I mentioned before of communication campaigns, we talked yesterday about how important it is to raise awareness of climate change and to provide people with information how their individual behavior is related to what's happening to the planet and what they can personally do about it. And communication tools and campaigns really need to be designed specifically for their target audience. Every marketing specialist will tell you this. Well, a few years ago, just an example, the German Environment Ministry, run by the Greens at the time, had a campaign for renewable energy. It was showing some girls in bikinis in front of solar panels and wind turbines. That's a campaign that is clearly not targeting women. Right? It is maybe efficiently targeting men, but not women. Women tend to perceive campaigns like this as that's an issue that's not for me. Or they really get annoyed by what they're seeing. But it's an example for campaigning on these issues or in the sector energy that is very much targeting men rather than women. So turning from the issues relating to mitigation, or to the issues relating to adaptation. So this is going to naturally have more focus on the developing world, but not only. What we learned yesterday when Lars was talking about the impact on developing countries, we learned that vulnerability and questions of adaptation are really largely social issues. And socioeconomic challenges. For example, I'm just going to pick up the example of natural disasters. We talked about floods and cyclones yesterday and the increase of those. And you have different impacts on women and men during natural disasters, at least very often, and we're learning more about that. For example, the flooding in 1999 in Bangladesh had five times as many females dying than males, many more women than men died during the flooding in Bangladesh. And there's a number of reasons for that, social reasons. One is that the warning information was given or provided from men to men in public spaces where women were not present, and it wasn't necessarily passed on to the family. Another is that in Bangladesh, as in other Asian countries, women do not learn how to swim. So during a flood, they need somebody to help them to get through water that's too deep to walk through. And thirdly, many of the women are not allowed to leave their home without a male relative accompanying them. So what happened was that they were waiting at home to be picked up by a male relative to be taken to a safe place. That's one example that always makes me feel really sad, that they're waiting at home with their children, and then it was too late. Another example that's it's not fun, but it balances this thing out a little bit. As the research that's been done around Hurricane Mitch in Central America, where the fatalities among men were higher than among women. And the reason there seems to be that men were engaging in much more risky behavior for the rescue of others, for the rescue of others and property, and lost their lives doing those kinds of heroic attempts for rescue. In other words, male identity can be quite fatal. That's cynical, but can't help it. But maybe the biggest thing here about gender and adaptation is really poverty. And we talked about that yesterday. In the sustainable development discourse, we talk about the feminization of poverty, which I don't think is a very fortunate choice of words, because feminization talk sounds like it was a process. What it is a fact. And has been for a long time. Among poor people in the developing world, but also in the developed world, we have a majority of women. People talk between 60-75% of those who are considered absolutely or relatively poor are women. Think about the single mothers and so on. So we learned yesterday how much more poor people will be affected by the impacts of climate change. And if you then take the gender lens and look at it through that, then you realize that it is indeed poor women who will be mostly affected by by the impacts of climate change. So if we want to do something about adaptation, if we want to help people to adapt, we have to think about who is it actually that we're dealing with. And we're dealing with a majority of women among the poor. For example, I want to give you another example of environmental impacts and what's the social effects of it, drought and deforestation. In many developing countries, it's women who are responsible for fetching water and firewood for the family. If you have drought and deforestation, what happens is that these women have to walk further and further and further to get the water and get the firewood. What then happens is that they need support to do it. They will ask their daughters, not their sons, to do this. The effect of this often is that girls drop out of school to do this work for the family rather than boys. You imagine the impact over the generations if you have that kind of split in education. It also means that women who spend 6 hours, 8 hours a day just to go and fetch the water for the family will not be able to do anything else to generate income. They have a little farmstead, and they go and fetch the water, they feed the family, they wash their clothes, and that's about as much as you can pack into a day. So it hampers, the environmental changes will hamper women even more to generate income for themselves, for things that they cannot produce, like medication, clothes for their shoes for their children, school fees, and so on. Another example that has a similar effect is what we call the gender division of labor. I mentioned this before, that women are more engaged in caring work than men are. And I discussed this with Lars last night, and he said he met somebody here who's a man, and he's looking after his mother. I said, it's very unusual. It is, so it's very good. It is usually something that women do within their families. They look after sick children, they look after the elderly. Environmental changes due to climate change have shown and will show health effects. We learned about that yesterday, like infectious diseases, but also the effects of heat waves, and we've seen that in Europe in 2003. If that continues, that women are responsible then to look after the sick in the family, if we have an increase in diseases, then we will have an increase in that work with a similar consequence as I discussed just before. Thinking of, again, maybe two more points here in relation to adaptation. One is what we know from development in general and from the beginning work on adaptation is that it needs to be context-specific in a specific community and there in the environment that they live in and the kind of work that they engage in. If you want to do effective community planning and development, it needs to be context-specific and it needs to be participatory. And from a Baha'i point of view, that's absolutely clear, and you need to consult with everybody and everybody needs to be involved. Otherwise, you don't really have intelligent plans and they're not likely to be implemented in the first place. So what we see, though, is that in traditional cultures, but in most cultures and countries around the globe, this is still the case, that women are not involved in decision-making at the community or at the national level, for that matter, as much as men are. For adaptation, that means that we're not going to have the high-quality and highly effective adaptation at the community level if we don't have women involved. We know this from development. We need to translate this into anything we do in terms of adaptation. And I don't think that is really being done at the moment. There's a big conference on climate change and adaptation happening this week in Paris, a specialist conference with about 100 people and a large range of contributions. And there was one mentioning of the empowerment of women in the whole of the abstracts that were submitted to this. So there's a way to go. The last point I wanted to make is about conflict. And we talked yesterday, I think several times, we talked about the increase or the likely increase of conflict over natural resources because of climate change and the impact it has on agriculture, water, and so on. Women in most cultures, and still today, play a role in their families and their communities that it's their role or their responsibility to prevent and resolve conflict. You see this in many traditional cultures, still today, many indigenous groups, but you can also show this when comparing the communication skills and habits of women and men in modern Western societies. So women due to their roles, tend to have that responsibility, or tend to go into that role of preventing and resolving conflict. I'm just highlighting this here, so if we will have more conflict over natural resources, including at the community level, then we better empower women, or we better create the spaces for women to empower themselves to play this role more effectively, or we might educate our boys and men in that regard as well. So just to close, I'm just going to say a few things about what now, what do we do with this if we know there are gender differences. Now, my own work said we were advocating. It means that we're trying to tell policymakers to take this into account, to do what we call gender mainstreaming. That is, when you look at climate change and what causes it, when you look at possible policies and instruments to mitigate the effects of climate change, and when you look at how to adapt to it, do it with a view to gender, with an awareness that there might be special aspects, special problems, and special opportunities when you look at women and men, take this into account. So it's a question of proper thinking about it, of doing some proper gender analysis when you're dealing with climate change. So look at women's and men's vulnerability, as the example I gave was in relation to poverty or in relation to the burdens that women carry with regard to water and firewood, for example, but also to build on the strengths and the skills that women and men specifically have in many cultures, for example, in relation to conflict. But we can also look at our own lives and check who is using energy for what. So in our case, that might go back to the one point I made in the beginning about energy use for transport, women and men, the one point that doesn't go down very well. Talk to developed countries people about this. It might be worth looking at that in your own families and your communities. Who is actually using energy for what? And do that with an awareness of the kind of role that people are taking in their family and in their community. I'm not saying they shouldn't take that role, but I'm saying that maybe we can think about more carbon neutral ways of, for example, being the guy who is involved in the male sports like football, or the guy who plays golf. There are different more climate neutral ways of manifesting, fulfilling that identity. I'm not saying that we should all just lose our identity, but it's very worthwhile to look at that and think about it. What am I doing here, and why am I doing this? Why am I driving so far? Why do I have to drive this big car? Why do I always get the speeding ticket? And make sure that when we, what we want to do this afternoon and tomorrow morning, when we think about what we do in our own lives, that when we consult within our families or we consult within our communities, that we make sure that we involve both the girls and the boys, both the women and the men, and listen to their perspectives on climate. So I concur with the speakers in the discussion yesterday that climate change is a huge issue and we need to address it with an utmost urgency. But we need to do it doing justice to all people. We talked about South and North yesterday, we had East and West, and I would like to add women and men and girls and boys and the young and the old. It is an issue that we cannot just address from a natural science or an engineering point of view. And I believe we know that to achieve that, we need to learn how to dialogue, to consult, and to collaborate in mutual respect and taking joint responsibility. We have different perspectives, we have different knowledge, we have different skills, but we all have something to add to the solution. And that's where I, coming from my background, that's why I like working on these issues, because we have so much to contribute in terms of consultation and dialogue, because we're, you know, we have to work in our communities. Well, thank you very much for your attention.